Succession number 24928, reel 16.
What was the feeling like when you heard VE Day had been declared, May the 8th?
There was a victory and I thought I'd written it all down here somewhere, but they spliced the main brace, and that's when we all, everybody on board, had a free drink. There was much raucous laughter, and somebody, they did have a little band on board, and that played proper music. There was quite a happy sort of atmosphere that the war was over in Europe. But then the thing came over the Tannoy system that the war might be over in Europe, but it hadn't finished in with Japan yet. And we still had to look out for submarines and problems if we were torpedoed, that sort of thing. I can't remember very much about what really happened then, but there was a certain amount of vociferous activity. Yeah. The return home was rather, in a way, traumatic. We eventually altered course to head northwards, and we knew then that we were heading into Australian waters. And then one morning, the announcement came over that the coast of Western Australia was in sight, and we would be pulling into Fremantle at 1000 hours or something like that.
What was the thing that you looked forward to the most on returning to Australia? The first thing you wanted to do?
Get off the bloody boat. Yeah.
And then?
Then go home up to the farm with my family. Yeah, that in itself was quite a business.
And what was the feeling like then when you saw the coast of Western Australia?
Well, the first thing that I looked for were the pines at Cottesloe. And they were the first things I saw. And then I looked for the dingo on the flour mill, which turned up, and for Rottnest Island over on the starboard. I saw all those things, and then I had a rather big feeling of elation that I had come home. We pulled into Fremantle Harbour, and the ship couldn't tie up because everybody moved over to the port side of the boat, and it got a hell of a list on. So we're all ordered to go back to our cabins down below so that they could tie the boat up. That was one thing. The other thing we thought was that, well, there'll be people to greet us on the wharf, which there weren't. Nobody greeted us at all, excepting a fella greeted the Air Force contingent as we came down the gangplank and made us assemble over in an area. And he had a little mini bus which he escorted us to. He had all our names, ranks and that. He put us onto the little bus and said, right, I'll take you round to your homes. And I said, well, my home's up at Spencer's Brook. And he said, that's all right, I know that. You'll be staying the night at such and such a spot. The memories of that particular session are quite interesting because we pulled up at a whole lot of houses to let the crew members off, but before they went into the house, this man went up and knocked on the door to tell the person, the female or whoever, that her husband had returned and was on the bus. On two occasions, I can recall seeing a fella pulling on his clothes and tearing off out the back of the house. I don't know what the outcome of this sort of situation ever was, but I did. I was the last person on the bus, quite frankly, because I was going up country. I was taken back to a place to stay for a couple of nights by this bloke, and I was allowed to make phone calls from there. He said that the numbers of places that he had been to where the Americans had been camping with the wife was just sickening. And this was the problem that faced a lot of the blokes that were coming home. When I was billeted for the nights, I think it was two nights, I was able to ring up to the farm, which caused hysterics and all sorts of things up there, and I was able to tell them that I'd got a leave pass to get onto the train to be up the following day. I rang my grandmother, whose remark was that she was absolutely certain that they never ever would have seen me again. I got put onto the train at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It must have been before that, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I think. It wasn't a very long trip up to Spencer's Brook. We slowly wound our way into the hinterland, and when we got to Spencer's Brook, the train was travelling as fast as it ever had, and it didn't bloody well pull up. It went on to Northam, and I could see my father and the family down below waiting for me. The buggers had forgotten to tell the people in charge that I wanted to get off at Spencer's Brook, so I was carried on the extra 20-odd miles to Northam, where I was picked up by an irate father. It wasn't a very good start, seeing they couldn't get petrol.
The very fact that you've made it through this adventure, and it wasn't like you were returning home from a holiday.
Mm.
The general sense of coming home, are you able to describe what that was like? The sense of being back home, of this anticipation, being on the train, in a couple of hours I'm going to see my family again.
Well, it was a certain euphoria about it. However, I'm afraid that I didn't feel boisterously happy about it. In fact, I couldn't feel happy about anything. I'd been too long not being in that sort of mood. And I can remember my sister having a go at me after I'd been home for a few days, and she said, "You don't seem to be the same person that you were when you went away. What is wrong?" Well, I couldn't very well bloody well tell her what was wrong, but I certainly knew myself. I just didn't feel up to being very happy about anything. I got back onto the farm and wandered round, and my father was sympathetic because he was a returned person, and he, I think, realised a bit of what I was going through. But my mother and my sister found it very difficult. They found that I was a rather dour, unhappy sort of person. Too bloody bad.
Well, interesting. Obviously, you've been contact with your mates. There was this sort of mateship that you now didn't have.
That's right.
How did you cope? How long did it take to sort of get over this sort of dour situation?
A couple of years, I suppose. Until I really didn't get over things until I met and married my wife. And she organised me. Good on you, honey.
Well, yeah. People talk about not having a house to come home to, not having a wife to come home to. Those people aren't around, basically, I understand.
No.
In a lot of cases.
A lot of cases, no. No. I got out and got around with a lot of people. I made a bit of an ass of myself in some cases, not to mention. After I'd been home for a while, I had to go back down to Perth to be demobbed. And after that, I was pushed out into the wide blue world to start off my new life.
Well, I get the impression, obviously, that people coming discharged. Thanks very much. See you in the next
That's
war.
Right.
How did you cope with that general situation?
Well, they didn't do that to me. They just said, well, thanks very much. Here's your discharge certificate and here's a badge to put in your coat and that's it. There was no, nothing very much done at all. It was a I don't know what the word is. It was a real letdown, I suppose. There was nobody to meet us when we came home. The war with Japan was still going, and we were looked upon as people who could have been best occupied if we were home fighting the Japs. There was no appreciation of what we had done with our bit in the war over in the Middle East and Italy. Those things didn't really occur.
Obviously, you mentioned not being able to really get along with your mother and sister. The fact that they just would not understand, even if you tried to tell them what you've been through. Is that the case?
Well, I think Mum understood. She did it. She understood. And my old granny, she came to the party too, and I think they understood the things about it. My grandmother was very much to the forefront in the First World War in a thing they ran there. I think it was called the Comfort Fund or something like that, and she had a lot to do with returned soldiers. And I think she understood. She was pretty good.
Well, the fact that you've been away on this huge adventure, and although an adventure that you might not want to wish on anyone else, I get the impression that you were missing it.
You missed the camaraderie and you missed the mob. You missed that side of it. But I was pretty excited, quite frankly, to think that I could do things back home. My biggest letdown was going back to my old job in Dalgetty's, where I was repeated, oh, hello, it's good to see you back. We'll try and find a job for you, sort of thing. I lasted there, I think, for 8 months and then told them to pack it. And I went back to farming with my father. That in itself lasted for a while, but he was a very sick man and the farm wasn't paying and we had to get rid of it. In the meantime, I had married Millicent and we were on the farm when we had to get rid of it. And we went over and joined up on her brother's property over in the place of Bidgeting, which was very nice. We had a son then, our Robert, and we were a little family. Things from then on began to be fairly okay, excepting my problem that I had with my back began to play up again, and I found great difficulty in working and walking.
What support were you to get from government, for instance, in relation to that?
they put me on a pension, and yes, I had support from the repat department. I was put into Hollywood Hospital for a while. I was there, I don't know how long, a couple of months. And in Hollywood, there was one of my old masters from Hale School, who was the he was the training and careers officer. And he said to me, "What are you doing here?" He said, you ought to be at the university. And I said, "I can't get to the university because I didn't get my leaving and I didn't get my junior." He said, "That doesn't matter. I'll fix things so that you can have an interview, and we should get you into the university in the disabled members training scheme. They call it the Dimwit scheme." So in 1950s, I did. I got into the university. I was there for the 3 years, and I got my double degree in zoology and botany. And that started a whole new life. And it really began something. That's when I sort of began to sort of wake up, I suppose.
There are people talk about the sort of return home to a country that pretty well hadn't been touched by a war at all.
Mm.
And that the sort of weird world that you'd been living in was actually the real world now.
Well, I suppose it could be. I don't know. I'm bugging if I know. No, it was a kind of come down finish to get back into Australia and find that really, well, I don't have to go and do what I've been doing again. I used to keep in touch with members of the crew, particularly Kevin Natras. Who was our wireless operator. He lived in South Australia. And Cookie Leon, our pilot, who came from South Africa. We kept in touch with them all the time. Eventually, Cookie migrated to Australia, and he's now over in the eastern states growing avocado pears. He was the avocado pear king in South Africa at North Transvaal, and now he's the avocado, well, he's retired now over in the eastern states. He was the avocado pear king over in the east. What he didn't know about an avocado pear wasn't worth knowing. The main thing about it, as far as we were concerned, he was a bloody good pilot, and he was a very steady type, and he had his head screwed on properly. And he didn't flap. He was a good bloke.
And people talking of continuing on their wartime career, some people joining the civilian army, things like that. Were you ever tempted to continue?
No. I tried to join Qantas as a radio operator, but they said they had too many applications, and they were sorry that I wasn't.
In relation to other conflicts that were to happen fairly shortly after the Second World War, obviously Korea was one. Were there any possibilities that you might take it up for something like that?
No.
What was the feeling when BP Day was announced?
I forget where I was then. I think I was in Northam, and the whole place went mad. People just absolutely went off their brains. I'm afraid I didn't. I didn't feel like doing that, but a lot of people really went nuts. It was a tremendous relief that that section of the war had finished.
What had you heard about the coming of the end for the Japanese? You hadn't heard about atomic bombs being dropped?
Well, we did know that one or two had been dropped, yes, but prior to that, we had no knowledge at all. No, we just knew that the war was drawing to a close, and a number of my friends who I did train with were flying Liberators from up north of WA over bombing in, I don't know, up top somewhere. One of them invited me to join on an operation with him, and this was before I got kicked out of the Air Force. Suggested I might like to come for a trip with him, and I said, well, yeah, fair enough. We were going to take off from Cunderdon, and the time came, and then he said, well, I don't think it'd be a good idea. I've mentioned the fact to my pilot, and the pilot says no. They got shot down. They were all rescued, but their aircraft got shot down. So I would have been on that trip, which would have been something.
Did you ever have problems with seeing what the war had been all made of?
Not really. I knew that we were there to get rid of the Hun out of the Middle East and Italy, and we did it. Now, you're asking me things that at the time wouldn't have really impressed themselves much upon me. We did know that we had to get rid of the Huns from the Middle East, and we had a job doing it.
People obviously, prior to the Second World War, the First World War was the war to end all.
That's right, war to end all.
The Second World War was the
war to end all wars, yeah. No, things wound down and that was it.
What benefits do you think you've gotten out of the whole experience?
I don't know. I've got the benefit of being alive and managing to come through. That's the biggest benefit. I don't know why I've been allowed to get away with it and a lot of other people didn't. I feel that's a privilege.
Did you learn anything? The human condition about the way the world is? Anything?
Not really. No. Sorry to be so vague, but no. I think that the main thing I learned was to survive. And to survive, you had to do what you were told and do your job and be available. But no, nothing much, really.
What did you take away then from your experience? I mean, obviously, you've got the diary that covers every day of the war virtually.
I've got a whole heap of mementos, lots and lots of mementos, which I had hoped to be able to put together and maybe write a little book. My log book is probably the main thing, because I don't know how many other gunners or wireless operators would have kept a log book like I did. I know Kevin Natras, our wireless operator, used to, because he used to copy what I'd written down. But a lot of the mob just used to write down operation number so and so, so many hours. That's it.
You related, for instance, if these tapes sit in a vault for the next 250 years, and 250 years' time, someone pulls out from this vault an 8-hour interview with you and I, met us and don't know who we are, what would you hope that person would get out of listening to your tape?
A kick. It might.
In what direction?
Well, I might get a bit of an interest in what we used to have to put up with, and what we did. it's unbelievable, really. I was asked to give a little talk to some people after I'd been back for a while about what went on in the war, and I tried to explain to them what we did in the way of dropping bombs and that, and they didn't seem to be all that impressed. I mean, it didn't mean much to them, dropping bombs on Germans. Why didn't you go up and drop them up in Japan? Yeah.
How do we sum up this interview? In relation to your experience during the Second World War, and what it's all meant?
It's been of interest, and it's been nice to be able to put on tape a lot of the things that happened to me during the war, and I would hope that eventually some of it might come back to me so that I can proceed to put it into a little book, hopefully.
We'll see what we can do.
Right.
Should we finish it there?
Okay, yes, I've had it.
Thank you very much.